So tonight's talk is titled "The Dhamma of Loneliness," and I came across the ideas for this talk in a chapter in the book "When Things Fall Apart" by Pema Chodron, and so I'll be reading from that book, and I'm reading from several other books related to what I'm reading from Pema, and sort of hopefully putting it all together. And so I wanted to start by reading what she has to say at the beginning of this chapter. In the middle way, there is no reference point. The mind with no reference point does not resolve itself, does not fixate or grasp. How could we possibly have no reference point? To have no reference point would be to change a deep-seated habitual response to the world, wanting to make it work out one way or the other. If I can't go left or right, I will die. When we don't go left or right, we feel like we're in a detox center. We're alone, cold turkey, with all the edginess that we've been trying to avoid by going left or right. That edginess can feel pretty heavy. However, years and years of going left or right, going to yes or no, going to right or wrong, has never really changed anything. Scrambling for security has never brought anything but momentary joy. It's like changing the positions of our legs in meditation. Our legs hurt from sitting cross-legged, so we move them. Then we feel, phew, what a relief. But 2.5 minutes later, we want to move them again. We keep moving around seeking pleasure, seeking comfort, and the satisfaction we get is very short-lived. We hear a lot about the pain of samsara, and we also hear about liberation. But we don't hear much about how painful it is to go from being completely stuck to becoming unstuck. The process of becoming unstuck requires tremendous bravery. Because basically, we are completely changing our way of perceiving reality, like changing our DNA. We are undoing a pattern that is not just our pattern, it's the human pattern. We project onto the world a zillion possibilities of attaining resolution. We can have whiter teeth, a weed-free lawn, a strife-free life, a world without embarrassment. We can live happily ever after. This pattern keeps us dissatisfied and causes a lot of suffering. So that's the premise that she presents for this whole teaching. And then she goes on. The experience of certain feelings can seem particularly pregnant with desire for resolution, loneliness, boredom, anxiety. Unless we can relax with these feelings, it's very hard to stay in the middle where when we experience them. We want victory or defeat, praise or blame. For example, if somebody abandons us, we don't want to be with that raw discomfort. Instead, we conjure up a familiar identity of ourselves as a hapless victim. Or maybe we avoid the rawness by acting out and righteously telling the person how messed up he or she is. We automatically want to cover our pain in one way or another, identifying with victory or victimhood. Usually we regard loneliness as an enemy. Heartache is not something we choose to invite in. It's restless and pregnant and hot with the desire to escape and find something or someone to keep us company. When we can rest in the middle, we can begin to have a non-threatening relationship with loneliness, a relaxing and cooling loneliness that completely turns our usual features, fearful patterns, upside down. Want to read, this is a little bit of poetry from Hafiz. Don't surrender your loneliness so quickly. Let it cut more deep. Let it ferment and season you as few human or even divine ingredients can. So he's saying that loneliness is useful. It can be where we confront ourselves. Pema goes on here. There are six ways of describing this cool loneliness. They are less desire, contentment, avoiding unnecessary activity, complete discipline, not wandering in the world of desire, and not seeking security from one's discursive thoughts. That's quite a list, huh? I want to read the list because it fascinated me when I first read it. That there are six ways of describing this kind of cool loneliness. By cool, she means acceptable, not like frigid. excuse me. They are less desire, contentment, avoiding unnecessary activity, complete discipline, not wandering in the world of desire, and not seeking security from our own discursive thoughts. So, and then she goes on. Less desire. Here's it's a pretty common Buddhist theme. Less desire is the willingness to be lonely without resolution when everything in us yearns for something to cheer us up and change our mood. Practicing this kind of loneliness is a way of sowing seeds so that fundamental restlessness decreases. When we're lonely, we get restless because I want something to happen, right? In meditation, for example, every time we label thinking, instead of getting endlessly run around by our thoughts, we are training in just this being here without dissociation. We can't do that now to the degree that we weren't willing to do it yesterday or the day before or last week consistently. Something shifts. We feel less desire in the sense of being less solidly seduced by our very important storylines. So even in the hot loneliness, even if the hot loneliness is there, and for 1.6 seconds we sit with that restlessness when yesterday we couldn't sit for even 1 second, that's the journey of a warrior. Notice how she's pointing to it. This starts with very small things, right? That's the path of bravery. The less we spin off and go crazy, the more we taste the satisfaction of cool loneliness. As the Zen master often said, one can be lonely and not be tossed away by it. I'll read some Jack Kornfeld. This is definitely Jack Kornfeld territory. And this is just the sentence I picked out of he's talking about this thing he does or did. There's an addictive quality to my relationship to food, contact, sensuality, and a deeper, unfulfilled loneliness. Unconsciously, I'm always trying to please people. That's a pretty good description of most of us. It's like there's an addictive quality to my relationship to food, contact, sensuality, and a deeper, unfulfilled loneliness. And it's like those are things we use. We use food, contact, sensuality. Those are things we use to sort of try and erase the lonely feeling, right? Unconsciously, I'm always trying to please people. That's another way we constantly end up trying to make happy, get away from lonely. Pema goes on. The second kind of loneliness is contentment. When we have nothing to lose. We don't have anything to lose, but being programmed in our guts to feel that we have a lot to lose. Our feeling that we have a lot to lose is rooted in fear of loneliness, of change, of anything that can't be resolved, of non-existence. The hope that we can avoid this feeling and the fear that we can't become our reference points. When we draw a line down the center of a page, we know who we are if we're on the right side and who we are if we're on the left side. But we don't know who we are when we don't put ourselves on either side. Then we just don't know what to do. We just don't know. We have no reference point, no hand to hold. At that point, we can either freak out or settle in. Contentment is a synonym for loneliness. Cool loneliness. Settling down with cool loneliness. We give up believing that being able to escape our loneliness is going to bring any lasting happiness or joy or sense of well-being or courage or strength. Usually, we have to give up this belief about a billion times, again and again, making friends with our jumpiness and dread, doing the same old thing a billion times with awareness. Then, without our even noticing, something begins to shift. We can just be lonely with no alternatives, content to be right there with the mood and texture of what's happening. I think this is this incredible to me to think about it in loneliness in this context. It's like this is just another mood, another thing that is naturally human. And it's just another thing we can learn to be able to go, oh, loneliness has arisen, and that's okay. We don't have to do something about it. We don't have to fix it, which is what we always want to do. We always want to do something to fix it. And she's saying somehow we have to learn to be content. I ran a yoga center once in my long past. My wife and I did. And we called the place Santosha. Santosha is the Sanskrit word for contentment. And it's been a big theme in my life for many, many years to sort of learn to be content. And as she says, a billion times, right? You try and then you mess up and then you try again. And it's a little more and a little more and a little more. And over the years, I think I've slowly become somewhat more content, which is a way of saying a little bit of improvement, which is all I can ever want anyway. Then the next kind of loneliness. The third kind of loneliness is avoiding unnecessary activities. When we're lonely in a hot way, we look for something to save us. We look for a way out. We get this queasy feeling that we call loneliness, and our minds just go wild trying to come up with companions to save us from our despair. That's called unnecessary activity. It's a way of keeping ourselves busy so we don't have to feel any pain. It could take the form of obsessively daydreaming of true romance, or turning a tidbit of gossip into the 6 o'clock news, or even going off by ourselves into the wilderness. The point is that in all of these activities, we are seeking companionship in our own usual, habitual way, using our same old repetitive ways of distancing ourselves from the demon loneliness. Could we just settle down and have some compassion and respect for ourselves? That's a great statement. Can we just settle down and have some compassion and respect for ourselves? What about practicing not jumping and grabbing when we begin to panic? Relaxing with loneliness is a worthy occupation. As the Japanese poet Ryokan says, if you want to find the meaning, stop chasing after so many things. And this sense of loneliness, I think, that she's talking about here is almost synonymous with boredom. It's like, oh God, this is so boring. How, when we get caught in that space of thinking it's something's really boring. And I want to share something from Joseph Goldstein here. This is from his book, Insight Meditation. And I love this particular chapter of this book. It's called Thank You, Boredom. There's a, can you imagine saying that to yourself? Thank you, boredom. Like anger and other emotions, boredom most often fools us into diverting our energies entirely to an external situation. Thus, it keeps us from liberating ourselves by seeing our relationship to the emotion itself. We make a great mistake about boredom when we think that comes because of a particular person or situation or activity. So much of the restlessness in our meditation practice and in our daily lives derives from this fundamental misunderstanding. How often do we try to find something new to recapture our interest, something more stimulating or more exciting? And how often does that too quickly become boring and dull? So we range off again, looking for another something better. To realize that boredom does not come from the object of our attention, but rather from the quality of our attention, is truly a transforming insight. Fritz Perls, one of those who brought Gestalt therapy to America, said, "Boredom is a lack of attention." Understanding this brings reality. This reality brings profound changes in our lives. Then boredom becomes a useful feedback for us. It's telling us not that the situation or person or meditation object is somehow lacking, but rather that our attention at that time is half-hearted. Instead of wallowing in boredom or complaining about it, we can see it as a friend saying, "Pay more attention, get closer, listen more carefully." I had a personal experience of this exact thing he's describing here on the first time I did a long retreat. It's about 2 weeks in, so as much I'd never sat more than 10 days before, so this is like 2 weeks of a month-long retreat. And I go into my teacher for my practice meeting, and he says, "Well, how are things?" And I said, "This stuff is really boring." And he says, he just looks straight at me, and first of all, he laughs, like he thinks it's hilarious, right? Which I was sort of startled by. I thought he'd take me seriously, and he's laughing instead. And he says, "You're just not paying enough attention." And just saying that, I started thinking, as the days went on after, that he was absolutely right. I was sort of half meditating, but sort of at the same time complaining and whining to myself, basically. "Oh, this stuff's like, how come nothing's ever happening? I want something to happen, blah, 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 blah." All that stuff that you get caught in all the time, wanting something to happen, instead of just paying attention and paying, like I talk about when I talk about meditating on the breath, like see if you can actually see the beginning of the breath and then every phase of the breath. Pay attention, really pay attention. And it's not boring anymore. It's, oh, look, this is pretty fast. Look what happens just with half a breath. It's really interesting if you start paying attention. It's just shifting how we think about things. And Joseph goes on, "When we are with people and feeling bored, can we listen a little more carefully, stepping off the train of our own inner commenting?" Ah, there's how often is it there we are in a conversation, and what we're doing is listening and figuring out at the same time what how we're going to get our accent, like how I'm going to say something wise and wonderful and add to this conversation, instead of just really listening, really paying attention. If we are sitting in meditation and feeling uninterested, can we come in closer to the object, not with force, but with gentleness and care? What is this experience we call the breath? If someone were holding your head underwater, would the breath be boring? Each breath is actually sustaining our life. Can we be with it fully, just once? When we recognize what boredom is, it becomes a great call to awaken. An interesting take on boredom, and which, as I said, is sort of related to this loneliness that Pema's been talking about. So that was type number three. Now we come to type number four of this cool loneliness she's talking about. Complete discipline is another component of cool loneliness. Complete discipline means that at every opportunity, we're willing to come back, just gently come back to the present moment. That's complete. This gentle, the key word there is gently, not force it. But we're just like, okay, my mind's wandered, let's go back to the present moment again. This is loneliness as complete discipline. We're willing to sit still, to just be there alone. We don't particularly have to cultivate this kind of loneliness. We could just sit still long enough to realize it's how things really are. We are fundamentally alone, and there's nothing anywhere to hold on to. Moreover, this is not a problem. In fact, it allows us to finally discover a completely unfabricated state of mind. Our habitual assumptions, all of our ideas about how things are, keep us from seeing anything in a fresh, open way. We say, oh yes, I know, but we don't know. We don't ultimately know anything. There's no certainty about anything. This basic truth hurts, and we want to run away from it. But coming back and relaxing with something as familiar as loneliness is good discipline for realizing the profundity of the unresolved moments of our lives. We are cheating ourselves when we run away from the ambiguity of loneliness. And more from Jack Kornfeld here. He's talking about his early days as a monastic. He was a monastic in Thailand and Burma for a number of years in the 60s. Since my vows included celibacy, I had to wrestle with much stronger desires, especially powerful sexual fantasies. I was a young man and I tried to notice these natural desires mindfully, but they kept returning with great energy. Because they are so strong, my teacher had me pay close attention to the states that came with the fantasy. He especially wanted me to notice how they arose. To my surprise, I discovered that preceding most of these fantasies were feelings of loneliness. I've always had difficulty with loneliness. I am a twin, and I suspect that I didn't even want to be alone in the womb. Accepting the loneliness was hard, but my teacher insisted I stay with it. As I explored the loneliness, I found insecurity and a needy kind of emptiness. That's something we have to take in too. That underneath that quote lonely feeling is insecurity and a needy kind of emptiness. Being afraid that something's wrong, that's insecurity. And then that needy kind of loneliness is like, of emptiness is like, but I need something. I have to have something. Something's got to be there. But there's nothing there to be there with. It's just, you're lonely. That's it. It's a startling thing to take in, shall we say. Okay. Pema goes on. Not wandering in the world of desire is another way of describing cool loneliness. Wandering in the world of desire involves looking for alternatives, seeking something to comfort us, food, drink, people. The word desire encompasses that addiction quality, the way we grab for something because we want to find a way to make things okay. That quality comes from never having grown up. We still want to go home and be able to open the refrigerator and find it full of our favorite goodies. When the going gets tough, we want to yell, Mom! But what we're doing as we progress along the path is leaving home and becoming homeless. Not wandering in the world of desire is about relating directly with how things are. Loneliness is not a problem. Loneliness is nothing to be solved. The same is true of any other experience we might have. I'm going to read these sentences again. Loneliness is not a problem. Loneliness is nothing to be solved. The same is true for any other experience we might have. There's a great passage in the sutta here I want to share. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. And the Buddha's disciples were called lone dwellers because of what Pema is talking about here. And this, the Buddha is explaining this, the Magala. Even though a bhikkhu who dwells thus lives in the vicinity of a village, associating with bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, with male and female lay followers, with kings and royal ministers, with sectarian teachers and the disciples, he is still called a lone dweller. For what reason? Because craving is his partner, and he has abandoned it. Therefore, he is a lone dweller. Craving is his partner, and he has abandoned it. It's an interesting way to think about it. Like, craving is our partner. Like, it's there, it's like drives us. And when you abandon it, then you are a lone dweller. It's an interesting image, I think. Okay. Now the last, this is, I love this last one. Another aspect of cool loneliness is not seeking security from one's discursive thoughts. The rug's being pulled. The jig is up. There's no way to get out of this one. We don't even seek the companionship of our own constant conversation with ourselves about how it is and how it isn't, whether it is or whether it isn't, whether it should or should, whether it shouldn't, whether it can or whether it can't. With cool loneliness, we do not expect security from our own internal chatter. We all have a little internal chatter, I assume. So. With cool loneliness, we do not expect security from our internal chatter. That's why we are instructed to label it thinking. It has no objective reality. It is transparent and ungraspable. We're encouraged to just touch that chatter and let it go, not make much ado about nothing. And this one has lots of things that other people have said. There's two I want to share in particular. This is from the Book of Joy. And this is actually the author talking about his life. So this is actually written by Douglas Abrams, who organized the interviews between the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu and recorded them, and then out of that came the book, and he's talking somewhat personally here. And then he goes back to the Dalai Lama, of course. Having grown up in Manhattan, surrounded by 7 million New Yorkers, I knew exactly what the Dalai Lama was saying. As a boy, I never really met the people who lived on our apartment floor. I would occasionally hear their doors close with an empty metallic clang and locks turn behind them. If we did see them while waiting for the elevator, few words were spoken and eyes were averted. I was always bewildered by this willful avoidance and finally concluded that it must have been a defense against the crush of so many people crowded together. You ever experience this? I identify with this. I still don't like, I don't like being in crowded rooms with lots of people. It's like, it's like, oh, there's just too much going on here, and I don't, and that space of not looking in people's eyes, not looking at people, sort of avoiding contact. It's like, oh, it's too much. But it's like you're lonely, that there's songs about being lonely in a crowded room. That's what we're talking about here. But he goes on. We are the same human beings, the Dalai Lama said, returning to one of his most profound refrains. No need for introduction. Same human face. Even when we see one another, we immediately know this is a human brother or sister. Whether you know them or not, you can smile and say hello. I thought at the times that I had smiled and spoken with warmth to a person waiting for an elevator or standing in a subway. Yes, sometimes my bid for human connection was met with confusion, since it was not the social expectation. But most often there was a relieved smile, as if we had broken a trance and were once again acknowledging our human bond. I don't know. I think I grew up in a world where people talk to people all the time. My father, I think that's my father's influence. There's this running family joke that my father could get on an escalator next to someone else, and by the time the escalator got to the top to the next floor, they'd be best friends. He was just he's one of these really friendly, social people. He would not hesitate to say hello and talk to people all the time. And it's like that's what he's talking, just this little willingness to make human contact. It's really a powerful thing to do. And then one last bit here. The Dalai Lama had explained that in Buddhism, there is the recognition of our interdependence on every level, socially, personally, and subatomically. The Dalai Lama had often emphasized that we are born and die totally dependent on others, and that the independence we think we experience in between is a myth. Isn't that a great line? We are born and die totally dependent on others, and that the independence we think we experience in between is a myth. I want to write that on my fridge or something. It's just the myth that we think we're independent. Hard one to take in. Anyhow. And then a little bit more Joseph Goldstein here. This is from another chapter in his book, Insight Meditation. It does not take too long to get a beginning sense that appearances arising in consciousness are not self, because we see how they just keep coming and going. A subtle identification can still take place, however, with the knowing faculty itself. I'm the one who knows knowing all these changing objects. We might believe that knowing is I, is self, because knowing or consciousness is much more subtle than the other arising objects. You might find it difficult at first to be mindful of it, But as the mind's power of steadiness, stillness, and clarity grows stronger, we can actually become aware of awareness. At certain stages of meditation practice, it becomes clear that consciousness itself is a changing process. This discovery can be unsettling, because for so long we've identified with the faculty of knowing as being most essentially who we are, taking it to be our soul, our self, our center. And now we see that it too, just like all other phenomena, continuously appear and pass away. And then this is the famous Joseph Goldstein story. Imagine yourself dropping out of an airplane and free falling for the first few minutes. Imagine the sense of exhilaration. But then you realize that you do not have a parachute. So you panic as you fall through space, falling, 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 filled with terror that you do not have a parachute. Until a certain moment arrives when you realize there is no ground. At that point of understanding, you just enjoy the ride. So this is like two aspects of this loneliness paradigm. One is that we just have to be like okay with it. And when we become okay with it, when we start to actually see it for what it is, it's just an empty mental phenomenon like everything else, like even consciousness. Then we can get to a place where we're not lonely anymore, because we realize there's nothing to be lonely about. It's an interesting place that I think this practice takes us eventually. And so, in summation, I guess, our practice leads us to learn how to work skillfully with loneliness. To not struggle with it, to calmly slow down, to intensify our awareness of it while not trying to figure it out. To just learn to say, and that's okay. My favorite mantra these days, and that's okay. But it's like we have to both learn to slow down, to intensify our awareness, and not try to figure it out. Three of our favorite activities: speed around, try and figure things out, and space out, instead of intensifying our awareness. This is what we're learning to do somehow, and be okay with all of that. And of course, I got a little bit of poetry here. I'm sure some of you have probably heard me read this, probably maybe even many times. It's one of my favorite poems of hers that points so clearly to what I'm talking about. So this is from Mary Oliver's book, Thirst. It's called Heavy. She's talking about a certain kind of loneliness. That time I thought I would not go any closer to grief without dying. I went closer, and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then said my friend Daniel, brave even among lions, "It's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief. It's all the way you embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down." So I went practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire, admire, admire the things of this world that are kind and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the sea geese on the steep waves, a love to which there is no reply. Real loneliness. So that's what I have to share with you all today.